Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, and I'm alive and well, along with Justin Robert Young and Bryce.
Hi.
Hey. Wait, hold on. Wait a minute. Who's dead now?
Well, it's Brian's turn to be dead.
Ooh.
But has he ever really truly lived? Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be back here on this microphone talking to you all here.
Well, in the land of the living, too.
I was actually resurrected, to be honest with you, and then coincided with some event yesterday. I don't want to get into the details. Don't want to offend anybody, whatnot. I need to jump right into some weird things. I'm going to ask you guys a question here. We're some travelers here. You guys some world travelers, and you some internet people. Have you ever used an internet cafe in this decade?
An internet cafe in this decade?
I don't think so.
No, not in the tens. Certainly in the aughts, during some traveling outside of the country, I stopped at an internet cafe, but not now. Not since smartphones. Smartphones have kind of relieved my need for an internet cafe.
Internet cafes in the 90s were this, you know, when people were looking at the internet and looking at this technology and trying to fit it into the world they understood, that was going to be this big thing, is there were going to be these chains of internet cafes as people go there to use computers and can access the internet, which was a dumb idea for the most part, because it's like, listen, the whole idea of this is we have personal computers. They go into the home. Like, well, not everybody's going to want to get a computer. Like, the price is going to fall. Yeah, but we think it was just people trying to create this sort of like, you know, coffee bar or whatever. You go there to do the stuff. And what do we have? We have Starbucks where you bring your own computer and you get Wi-Fi and you use that. Yeah. But that's not an internet cafe. That is not what that is. But they do exist in other parts of the world where, one, computers are still expensive. Two, internet access can be problematic where you don't have telephone access. So they are a real thing. They do solve a problem for some people.
Right. These are still big in China and South Korea, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're still – and they're places where they are – they absolutely certainly do fill a niche. But in the United States, they didn't become – there were plans. We're going to launch a big launch chain of internet cafes so people go there because it's like people saw dollar signs, you know. But
yeah.
And you still do. But again, you go to like Kinko's office and somehow whatever like this. So what's – the danger of using an internet cafe, of course, these computers, you don't necessarily know what kind of software is on there. You don't know what's going to, you know –
spyware.
Who's seeing your stuff? Yeah. You don't know that. And so what would be the worst thing that happen if you use some sort of strange internet cafe?
Well, if you get a keylogger, right? They get your password, you log into your email or something, you log into your bank maybe.
I think that's the biggest thing. But it is a little bit of the old, like, you know, you can't con an honest John, right? Where you are only as susceptible to an internet cafe as trusting of it as you are. So if you were maximum trusting, then yes, you could be maximum affected by it.
So I want you to imagine you're in a foreign country and you're using an internet cafe. What is the worst outcome you could imagine?
I would say my identity stolen.
Yeah, right. Someone gets into like my Google account and changes those passwords.
Oh, actually, no. You want to know what? I can think worse. Okay. If there's something where I'm entering in my home address.
Oh.
Like they could just come and they would know where I am and where I'm going, and they could like
it could be owned by like the mafia or something like that too, like some sort of foreign mafia. They chop off fingers and put them in bottles. I have a news report here, Bryce. I want you to play the first item there,
okay,
to see an example of what probably could be the worst situation that could happen at an internet cafe.
Oh my God,
snakes!
Oh my God, goddamn!
In net cafe.
This is just April 8th, 2017. What's happening?
Guy goes to open up a door in the internet cafe, and a rat snake jumps through the door, bites the guy, chases him into this Thailand internet cafe.
What? Hold on. We have to go back. Hey, okay. So it's a Saturday, so this is the time code. And it's just at – how does he get in?
So it bites the guy and he drags it in, right?
Oh yeah, the snake sees a guy walking out, and then he strikes. He gets in. The guy doesn't realize until it's too. Oh my god! Oh my god!
Well, he also just does this just this amazing pratfall of like he goes totally here. Bryce, pause it with him at his most vertical.
At his most vertical? Okay.
Oh no, sorry. Oh, no, horizontal.
Horizontal, yeah.
Yeah, he goes fully horizontal.
Wow. And then the snake skitters away like under two other guys.
Yes. So, no, the snake is looking for shelter, and that is found under the feet of two dudes, no doubt playing League of Legends.
And those guys are not wearing shoes either.
No.
That's wild. This was less than a week ago.
So this is in Thailand, according to the YouTube video. And now everybody is just kind of like trying to stay away. Oh,
this other angle, the multi-angle.
The other angle.
They've just like given up this room. Like in like 20 minutes from this video, the snake has owned this net cafe.
20 minutes from this video, I'm throwing gasoline everywhere. people are like, and the chat room, of course, knew snakes. They knew this was going to be snakes. I have a second video there because the question is like, is that real? Can a snake really jump like that? So we found a video of a rat snake to show you just what they're capable of. Just why we should never go outside, why you should never go anywhere.
Oh my God.
And the title is Rat Snake Jumping Up to 2 Meters High.
I saw the
And if you go about halfway into it, you'll see the snake start to stand up. Go further in.
Little snake. He's in a backyard garden. He's on a tree. There's like a
watch this. It's slithering up. It's slithering up. Okay. It's on this weird Dagobah looking tree stump kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you're going to see something terrifying now.
So oh it's my like, God. It's, all right. So it's raising up as if somebody was playing a flute in an Indian basket. It is. Oh God.
Oh, how. How high up is that? That's probably
well, it's part of the video. Two meters.
High. 2 meters. Oh my God!
This could bite you in the face,
and then it just goes away. It's just done.
Maybe is it done or is it going to jump? What's it going to do next? We don't know.
Oh man,
snakes.
Snakes are scary, y'all.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah, here you are, your internet cafe. Hey, guys, that was a great session. I'm going to go home now. Thanks. Yeah. Boom.
Snake jumped right through the screen door or wherever, too, right? You just – can we go back? I just want to see that one reverse angle one more time. That guy we got to include this link in the show notes or something.
Okay.
Because it is just comical. He just like drop kicks the snake into thin air. He drop kicks his friend.
He hits another guy. Yeah. He like,
God. Yeah. He takes out somebody else with it.
My God. Geez.
Jeez.
Oh, so good. So it's all right. So there we go. Of course it's snakes. But of course you can support us at patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where we keep this show rolling. No matter which of our co-hosts are dead, no matter how many things we got going on, we make sure that you get an episode of Weird Things each and every week. And that's because you support us at patreon.com/weirdthings. That's Thank right. you guys so much.
This is very appreciated. Who else is going to bring you all the terrifying snake news?
I know. Well, I like that, Andrew, that you've been gone the last 2 weeks, but much like a snake leaping through an internet cafe door, you have reasserted your dominance immediately.
Yes, exactly. Let you know what this is all about here.
I'm afraid of like how much if we started off with two terrifying snake videos. I'm worried about how far we go.
It's not going to be all terrifying snake videos. So this is actually we're going to some space talk here. We're going to do a little bit of space.
Okay.
So we've talked a bit about like the future of like where we're going to go and what's the likelihood. And there was actually an article that came out today, which was dismissive of the idea of being able to terraform Mars, which, you know, I've always had the opinion. Terraforming Mars might be more problematic than we realize, and there's going to be a lot of environmental concerns, et cetera. But there are many other reasons to go into space, a lot of other reasons to go into space. There's research, et cetera. Another one is that's been proposed is the idea of going out there to get minerals and materials and resources. Well, apparently, Goldman Sachs has issued a report claiming that mining asteroids for precious metals is a realistic goal. They've issued a report exploring the possibility of using an asteroid-grabbing spacecraft to extract platinum from space rocks. And the report kind of goes into more suggesting, you know, what the cost of that could be versus how much you could get from, you know, a hypothetically, if you took one particular asteroid, how it could be worth like $10,000 quadrillion, which, of course, I think the price, the value of the material would kind of fall once rapidly in abundance. But the point is, that is something that financial organizations and institutions are now realistically looking at doing. We're in an era where you have private space companies that are scaling up and increasing the capabilities of what they can do. And this may be something that gets financed at a certain point.
Wow.
Is space mining in our future? Is that a viable business? Is this something we're going to see sooner than later?
So that's like you mentioned, a very like optimistic initial price for this platinum. $50 billion for a single asteroid. But at some point, when does the novelty factor of that price come down?
Of course. Of course.
It's still a precious metal, yeah. Right? Like platinum mines now are still, you know, nickel mines now are you know, but fortunes are made based on what they can yield. I think what's really exciting about this is the idea that, you know, Goldman Sachs isn't in the like sci-fi game, right? Like they are an investment bank, and the idea is that they are signaling that this is something that will require business investment and might yield tremendous profits. It is an upside that they believe people should be interested in, and that's something that, like, you know, that's pretty rad. People putting their money where their mouth is, literally.
I mean, look at this quote. Successful asteroid mining would likely crater the global price of platinum with a single 500-meter-wide asteroid containing 175 times global output. That's incredible.
For sure. But also understand that what's most interesting isn't the things that are just ornamental in value but have practical value. And there's certain materials, like let's say tellurium, which is used in solar panels and solar cells. And I don't know that we would get abundant amounts of that out of asteroids, but if you did have a tremendously great source of tellurium, that's great because that means that we can dramatically lower the cost of producing solar panels. Mm. You know, rare earth mines cost about $1 billion to be able to put those mines together and start mining that stuff out of the ground. If we have these very, very cheap sources for these materials, then all of a sudden we can lower the cost of a lot of these technologies that are transformative and can help the planet. So that's another way to look at it. Yes, it craters the market on platinum, but platinum's also rare because it's useful. We use it in a lot of industrial applications.
So what is next after asteroid mining? Is planet mining a potential avenue?
The problem with planet mining is that the advantage of asteroid mining over planet mining is twofold. One is we think that on asteroids, things may be in greater concentrations because they formed at a period before the heavy minerals sank down into the crust or further down into the mantle, et cetera. Mm. We're still beginning to understand the chemistry of that. That's one thing, is we think we might get just bigger, larger rocks and pure veins where you don't have to do like on earth mining, you have to go through. And the advantage of asteroid mining over, let's say, earth mining isn't that it's not here on earth. It's just that your parts per thousand of trying to get to these materials and the amount of earth you have to move to get to them.
Yeah.
Are problematic. The other thing, the primary reason why mining an asteroid versus, let's say, mining Mars makes more sense is that to ship that from an asteroid to Earth doesn't require a lot of fuel because you don't have a high escape velocity. Mars is still 40% Earth gravity, which means you need roughly 40% the amount of fuel to get that off the surface of Mars that you would, let's say, off the surface of Earth. But if you have an asteroid, let's say Ceres, which has 3% of Earth's gravity, then it just takes a tiny amount of fuel to reach escape velocity there and put it in intercept course with Earth.
Wow.
That's why that's of interest, is that it could be, with the right technology, you can figure out your fuel costs, et cetera, and you can do the math and say, yeah, no, this is cost effective, but we need the technology. We don't need a magic energy production machine. We just need to figure out how to build rockets in mass, how to do reusability, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And now that we are in the dawning of the reusable rocket era, now these things are something that an institution like Goldman Sachs wants to kind of look more mm-hmm. into as a business opportunity.
I know there have been more inquiries have been made into what could you do on the moon. The moon has a lot of aluminum. Now, aluminum on the moon, maybe not practical to bring to Earth, but when you start talking about massive space construction and building big things, spacecraft and habitats, et cetera,
yeah.
Does the moon become an interesting place to build stuff? Because you got enough gravity to sort of orient things and to keep things in one specific spot, not too much gravity that escape velocity is difficult.
Space.
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, we've had conversations that the first, trillionaire is going to come from space, right? Like that's something that is just like it's the expansion opportunities money wise are almost unfathomable, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as these economies expand and you look at how now Jeff Bezos is getting very close to Bill Gates in income level, you know, Jeff Bezos could become the richest man in the world in another few years' time. He's spending $1 billion a year on Blue Origin, his own private space company. $1 billion a year he's funding this. And I don't know, I would imagine, you know, the ESA budget is a few billion dollars. That's the European Space Agency. The Chinese have theirs and all that. But that ranks up there for with nation state status of what he's spending, yeah. And particularly what he's doing into one specific kind of craft, it's competitive. And so we're in an era where we have individuals like him and others who are spending billions of dollars developing space technology. And we've never had that before in history, And people ask me, why am I so optimistic on space? We've never had this many intelligent, resource rich people committing money to that. And that's what's it going to be like 20 years from now? 20 years can pass very, very quickly. And the next thing you know, I think we're going to be in a radically different situation.
Well, I mean, the money's there too. It's like, yeah. It's not even just, you know, like you said, like Bezos is putting a lot into it. Obviously Elon Musk has, you know, built a tremendous company. But when you look at something like that, and again, to me, what's exciting is that it's Goldman Sachs saying it, right? That it's like, this is not, you know, somebody that has a vested interest. That what Goldman Sachs has a vested interest in is, where's that money coming in? Like where are we going to spend our money, and where do we believe other people should be spending their money? That's super pumping. That's awesome.
Well, I'll give you an example though of how hard it is to change mindsets. One of the first amazing meetings, the James Randi Educational Foundation, we had a physicist who was a well-known physicist within the physics community, somebody I respected quite a lot. And he did a talk, and one of the things he was really dismissive of was space mining. And I said, you know, obviously the technology right now isn't there, but as technology progresses, I don't see why we would say this is a stupid idea. And he's like, well, here's the thing. You know, it says right now it costs $20,000 a pound, you know, put something into orbit. Gold's only, $3,000 or whatever. I forget what the price was at that point. You know, he had this sort of dismissive, like, you know, gold, you know, per ounce or whatever, says, you know, it costs more than you would ever get. And I said to him, we're not shipping bricks of gold into space.
Yeah.
We're going to asteroids that have a very low delta V escape velocity and shipping it from there to Earth. So it doesn't, you know, and he was just, he just didn't want to hear that. And I remember even talking to Randy, and Randy's like, well, you got to get it back on Earth. What are you going to crash it in? I'm like, well, you just use aerobraking or parachutes and stuff. You don't have to expend that amount of fuel to bring it back down. You can just convert that kinetic. I mean, it was just this, and I respect Randy immensely, but there was just, but got this kind of argument. I'm like, I know we can't do that right now, but the physics is on the side of this is possible, mm-hmm. not sure. that it's impossible. And the economics just says, you know, but it was just a weird, different kind of way of thinking.
I mean, also how much of that is just, you know, the fact that as it's kind of revealing itself day by day, even now, we're thawing out our space ambitions. Right. Yeah. You know, there was this kind of end for momentum in terms of space exploration. And now we are moving at a pace that is not only a breakneck compared to where we were, but also just the idea, like the possibilities are just kind of opening up and blooming in a way that they probably haven't since the early 70s.
Yep. So anyhow, I know I get to be a broken record on this, but it just being a very interesting to see all of a sudden here's this, you know, report from there. I found something that was kind of interesting that I wanted to bring up. And y'all remember Google Books?
Oh, sure. This is the project that would go and scan, like, the Guggenheim collection. They would go and scan books, and you could search the text of these books, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It also, I think, dawned that and Gmail were kind of also, to me, the first biggest moments when Google's friction with people, I think, kind of reared its head a little bit, because Google was criticized very, very heavily for the by publishers and authors for the idea that, like, you know, this was the march toward, you know, book piracy being the rule, the norm and not the exception.
So, you know, it was a great, ambitious project, and a couple of lawsuits were fought over this between the Authors Guild, et cetera, because Authors Guild was concerned about the fact that Google wanted to index all these books and then make them widely available. But the problem was that authors were afraid that, well, if you're making these books widely available, and, you know, are people going to still buy books? And I saw both sides of the issue. You know, I understood, like, hey, we don't want to lose these things forever. We want to have them make them available. As an author, though, you have this anxiety about, like, well, what happens when you have all these books online and somebody doesn't need to buy a book? And there was this, no, there'll be protections. But there were examples early on of people showed, like, how you could take the samples and recreate an entire book from doing that. And I think it was, you know, my frustration was that it was Google looking at this sort of like this, hey, here's another thing that we can index and make available. You know, we're going to do this great, noble thing, you know, yada, 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 profit. But also really it was about, you know, Google's sort of profit, you know, and they, as much as they said, no, it's about the better for the world and all of the sort of stuff, they are a company. And they're a company that saw an asset that could be exploited and could be used. And there are arguments to say, like, well, it's a great resource, et cetera. But anyhow, there was a long lawsuit with the Authors Guild. And eventually Google basically won out and saying works that were – the Google side won out. But it went on so long that Google Books sort of, like, the amount of effort they put into it just declined tremendously. And some people have argued, like, yeah, that's the problem, is this big company fought to be able to go do this and made it difficult for anybody else who wanted to do, if you were a publisher or somebody said, like, hey, we just want to do digital rights and make them indexable, whatever, but we want to charge a fee. You didn't do that because Google was going to go do this and it changed the market. So anyhow, long story short, there's an article that talks about what happened to Google Books, this big ambitious effort, and how it really has sort of, it's still there, but it's not what it used to be.
Wow. So what do you think, and obviously, as you pointed out, this is about AdWords. You know, the way that, you know, the golden goose for Google, the reason why they are able to continue to be a gigantic juggernaut is because they fundamentally changed the game and owned such a large part of online advertising with AdWords. And this was another way that you could find relevant, useful information that they could put relevant, useful ads next to, which is stock and trade. Do you think that there could have been a better way for this to end out that also had Google, you know, getting this kind of content, but maybe didn't run so far afoul of the authors?
I think that problem number one was that, and we had these discussions years ago, I think, on this very show about that. And my argument was that the ad revenue that you would get from there would never equal what you get paid for someone to read a book. And the thing is with books, there's only finite amount of time that people have to spend to read books, right? It's not a thing where, Facebook and Instagram do the same thing, do things like they try to figure out how they can increase the number of ad impressions and make those ad impressions highly, highly targeted. So the more ads you get, They increase the ad revenue by making them more specifically targeted. It can charge more. Books and things like that, as you commoditize these things, you're going to see the value you get per 100 words or 1,000 words is just going to follow that same decline, where it used to be that a book could be worth X amount of dollars, then it drops. And granted, that's the way of the world and the way many things work. But you could say, like, I don't want to accelerate that, you know, as a author, I don't want to accelerate the cost. I don't, you know, maybe there should be a floor to what my books cost. And I see that publishers feel that way. Like, you look at the pricing on my book, let's say my new book, Angel Killer, my publishers price that at a level that, you know, the floor that they see it at, you know, which is like $15 for an ebook, which there could be debate over whether or not that's where that floor should be.
There certainly could be.
Yeah, but there is a discussion about that, about what is that. And I don't think the floor should be 30 cents. You know, I think it should be higher than that. But other people, yeah. You know, and when you do things that treat them as a commodity and you have a finite audience, you can only reduce that floor so much, bring it lower to the point that it's not worth it to do it. And I think that was the problem that Google Books faced, is that if you're looking, if it was like any other sort of Google asset or Google, anything else Google commoditized, the price per impression fell tremendously. That's why, you know, you get like The Guardian is asking for you to help support them because their ad revenue is declining because there's so much more stuff in that information space. And that was my fear with Google Books, was this isn't a great thing. I mean, it's a great thing from a research point of view, and I don't want to undervalue that, but as an author, you're like, hey, you know, I'm going to watch the value of this rapidly just, you know, decline if I'm okay with this.
You know, and that is the funny thing is, if you look at The Guardian and the publishing industry, is that both are industries that previously were intensely popular, cornerstones of our culture, that made their money fairly regularly, and then were kind of revealed to have this startlingly high overhead for mm-hmm. something that was moving increasingly digital, where more players could compete with them. And no matter what, they still got to run these plants. They still got to run these printing presses, you know, both newspapers and the publishing industry. And that's, I think, kind of clouded the judgment on all sides, on both what they're going to fight and what they're going to push forward.
Yeah. Yeah, there have been use for, like, you know, there was a program somebody mentioned before and after things, like, you could say, hey, I will make my book like Creative Commons if enough people support it to go do that, which my argument is like, well, if there's enough people have an interest in that book, then the book has life in it.
Creative Commons.
Yeah. It's kind of like you're, it's sort of like, it's an interesting idea, but I'm like, it's kind of counterintuitive to me. Like, I don't think that will really work because it's an interesting area. It certainly is a very, very interesting area. And the idea, we don't want things to get lost. You know, what do we do that? But also, when you trust something to a corporate partner, you're hoping that they're going to have their interest is going to stay. And we've seen this, that's the big thing with Google. Had a lot of ambitious ideas 10, 15 years ago, things that they wanted to do that were going to change the world. One of the things that was floated around was they were going to think about, like, how do you make like telephone calls free or internet free? That was a real Google initiative that they were looking into, the idea of like, let's just get rid of the cost of that and we can subsidize with ads or whatever. And then they did a little more math on that. They realized that wasn't a realistic thing. And, you know, before the Android came out, that was a big talk that maybe Google was going to make this free phone. Okay. And, you know, it's a free OS, but they still not free in the sense that your calls are free. With the book thing, like, we're going to change books, make this wonderful resource. And then they didn't. And then it's like, yeah, well, what happened? Is it because it wasn't profitable? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Not to say institutions are any better at doing that.
But also, I have not read that piece about it. Is there any other like big takeaways that you found in that behind the scenes look at Google Books?
Part of what they talk about, like, is that they've indexed a lot of books. They have libraries they still they cooperate with. And they help them go do that. They still are indexing books. There still was a technology problem too, of like how intensive or expensive it was to be able to do that. I think that it feels very much like an orphan project, though, in that if Google came to me, if Google said to authors like me, said, hey, how would you like to put your book into your upload your digital file to like a lockbox kind of thing? and, you know, a 20-year lockbox, and then 20 years time, you know, we'll email you, or what, or 10 years time, we'll ask you, do you want to make this freely available or not? And if you say yes, then we'll unlock it. Otherwise, we'll keep it in this vault, knowing that once copyright goes ends, you know, 70 years or whatever from your death or whatever, that then it'll be available. That would be a great program. I'd be like, yeah, I'll put all my books in there, showing that if something happens to me or whatever, they're not lost forever. And that's something they, you know, they didn't do, which I think would have been a cool thing to do, because I've got a lot of works, even DVDs and stuff like that, that, yeah, I would put that into. You know, I went through cleaning out my house in Florida, and I find, you know, a lot of my older works, DVDs and stuff like that, that, like, this has value to people, and I don't need to make revenue from this. I would like to make some of this available out there, and trying to jump through a lot of creative comments, you know, common sort of hoops and other things and stuff like that is like, you kind of, I can make it available now, but I would rather say, hey, ask me in 5 years, you know, let me upload this, and then I can make it go through. I think that would be tremendously valuable.
Yeah.
You know, I would put a lot of my books in that and do that and say, yeah, I'll let this time out after a specific amount of time. Because the problem is that by the time these things time out or whatever, I decide to release it, I may not have those digital formats anymore. And asking me to go back and find those digital formats to make it available, I'm not going to do that. I'm lazy.
Sure.
That's a really good point. And also just putting the onus on them that it's like, hey, you guys are probably going to have the resources to convert stuff to a different, you know, a file format if you're really, you know, committed to this project. Like yeah. I'd rather entrust you with the future of it.
I could see how, you know, there is. Google could have made a big dent in science research journals, in science papers, research journals, stuff like that. And they had initiatives. There's Google Scholar, all that. But like, man, like if you guys want to index valuable information and make it available, you know, maybe go for things that, you know, they went for things that had commercial value immediately, the present commercial value, video, YouTube videos, this sort of stuff. But go for things that have these edge cases, but provide more, you know, science journals that may only get read by 100 people, but having that accessible to 100 people. And they did index some stuff, but there wasn't like a publish via Google method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To my knowledge, there could have been some program. So
part of Google Books, I bet, was also a response to Amazon having such great success with digital literature, right?
I remember Google Books started well before the Kindle and the Kindle format.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
No, this is like ebooks back when ebooks were download a PDF and read it on your desktop. Oh, like, right. You know.
Yeah. I mean, it's a way back thing. We got one more thing here, guys. Got a Bigfoot sighting for you.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. All right. It's Wiley some bee. Proof? I'll tell you what. We're going to find him this time. Where are we looking, Andrew?
Clearest ever Bigfoot on camera. Mythical beast allegedly caught on video.
All right, here we go.
It's in Oregon, so we have a plus that it's in Oregon.
So it's in front of a lake. We got about three people here, maybe four with the camera person. Hold on, go back. Oh, wait, autoplayed. This is a very tiny.
You know, it's amazing watching your little skeptical minds, your cynical minds, not want to process.
Here we go. This is in Oregon. The article reads, Bigfoot hunters claim this could be the clearest yet video of the mythological creature. The footage is said to be have taken during a family trip to Oregon State. The man is talking to a camera. He's next to the Wild Horse Lake in the Steens Mountains. All we can see in all right, Bryce. No need to laugh. No need to
I'm
laugh.
Telling you,
come
Bryce.
On.
I'm sorry. It's just so small.
All right, big shot. Like, did you go ahead and explain what we're looking at here for the audio listeners if you want to be Mr. Gigglepuss?
Sure. So the you got a man talking in front of a lake, and you see a figure emerge from the lake on the other side of the lake. And they just kind of track it a little bit, but it's incredibly small. There's no way you could pull detail out of that. Like,
am I crazy? I would say
Mr. Astronomer. That star's really, really small. I don't think there's any way you can pull detail out of that. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Physicist. Those atoms are too small. I don't think we have any detail there, and I refuse your theory.
But there's not even Zoom. He didn't even Zoom with the camera.
Oh, Bryce, the expert on how to shoot Bigfoot when you don't know you're going to shoot Bigfoot photos. Don't actually shoot Bigfoot.
Okay.
So the one thing I think you can say is that the footage is not as close as the famous Pedersen-Gimlin footage,
right,
which is the iconic, you know, the loping Zabruder walk
film of Bigfoot.
The Zabruder film, yeah, of a Bigfoot. When you see just a silhouette of Bigfoot, it is from that video. So I guess it is a bold claim to say clearest video yet when they seem to be a little bit further away,
right,
than the gold standard.
I mean,
but Bryce, you seem skeptical.
I am skeptical. I mean, not only is this video very like compressed and low quality for the web already, but they're so far away from it.
You got to wonder what the shots that guy is taking, because it's three people looking on, and there's one dude with suspenders, and he's got what looks to be some kind of DSLR.
Yeah.
He pulls up and starts shooting. So presumably there's some higher quality footage of him.
I mean, potentially, but you can also see, like, so you see the figure sort of emerge from the lake at the very start of the clip, but
it does kind of look like something that, you know, would be in like the first Cloverfield movie, right? Like it's just something that's happening kind of in the background.
Found footage, Bigfoot. Well, wait, now that's
everything. Andrew, a resident, a Bigfoot expert, how would you rank this footage and specifically the claim that it is the clearest ever?
Well, the people are clear in the video.
Crystal.
So I've mentioned this before. I was on a panel once with a bunch of Bigfoot believers kind of thing. Yeah. And I say believers like this was like, I was the lone skeptic and I was the weirdo there because I didn't accept the fact that Bigfoot's like this real thing. And everybody there had these kind of personal, almost religious connections with Bigfoot, which was sort of fascinating to me. And, you know, the idea that, and they're like, we think he could be mythical. He could be interdimensional. He could be this. And they just accepted this worldview that was not exactly what I would consider empirical. I realized this was not a scientific sort of discussion. It was a religious discussion.
Yeah,
and I could have just as well been in a room with a group of people talking about, you know, the validity of God. And that was here yet again, more Bigfoot images without any close-ups of Bigfoot. We don't have, there are zero good shots of Bigfoot. There are zero good close-up shots of Bigfoot. Not a small percentage, zero. Yeah. It's always running in the background in the distance. And even with the age of telephoto lenses and stuff where you could get images that are much closer to it, why is this?
Right.
Because he's that fast. All right, solved
cameras.
It.
He's Flash. He's Mother Nature's Flash.
Well, I mean, I think that there is a question, especially when we were pouring through these a lot more on weird things, that you would tend to find two different kinds of Bigfoot videos. There are either people that are trying to perpetrate a hoax or well-meaning believers who are taking pictures of things that they believe honestly to be Bigfoot. Where do you think this one falls in, Andrew?
I think some people shot some nice video footage and like, oh, what is this kind of thing? And I think that the people who are there, we don't have any interviews with them. I think they probably have an idea of what that is, but they have not, you know, again, where are the photos? You know, well, the photos are nowhere to be seen. So why is that? You know, what do the interviews with the people say? So I think it's the kind of thing that on closer inspection, it doesn't hold up. And one of the things I've noticed with my friends who are hardcore believers and stuff, they don't like to ask critical questions about the things they believe in. They seem almost allergic to, you know, questioning this thing. They don't want to. And they will also avoid, well, there's a, you know, there's an argument that debunks that. Well, those debunkers are always debunking. Do you want to read it? Nope.
Yeah.
Okay. All right then. So we're in the subject of religion.
I mean, I think that there is equal odds that they caught video of someone skinny dipping in this lake and then fleeing these people who are doing something on the other side. Like,
yeah,
so. Not even the
people are pointing out that Brian is not on this episode, and we and I don't know if we can account for his whereabouts over the last few days. So let's also leave that open as a possibility.
He did say he was going to Oregon yesterday. So,
Finally, you know, you can't really get clean until you jump in the lakes of the Steen Mountains.
True that. Gentlemen, do we want to jump into picks?
Sure. I got a pick.
Okay.
I don't know if it is an enthusiastic pick, but it is something that I watched over the weekend, and that is Fantastic Beasts and How to Find Them, the first spin-off of the Harry Potter universe, not featuring Harry Potter. It is a prequel of sorts, written by J.K. Rowling, directed by David Yates. I found this movie to be very frustrating, and certainly in its plotting and story. And yet, by the end of it, I was kind of charmed by a few of the characters, if kind of befuddled by some of their behavior. So, if you're into the Harry Potter universe, I think that there are moments where you certainly get enough of that that world-building rush to make it worth your while, although I presume you probably already saw it if you are really that into Harry Potter. But if you kind of wanted a better, like, adults do magic and, you know, engage with each other in violent fashion with magic, then I would probably suggest Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I went and saw Fantastic Beasts in the theater. And I was kind of in the same boat as you, Justin, in that I didn't really think that the characters were acting in their best interests or just with the best
motivation. Morally or ethically or consistently.
Yeah. But I also recognize that this is on some level probably aimed for children. I mean,
it's for babies.
No, God damn it. It just,
I mean, there's some fairly heavy themes here for kids, you know, sure. Specifically the one of child abuse, which is like not hinted, but fairly explicitly kind of, explained.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that my biggest fear is that J.K. Rowling is kind of entering into a similar phase that kind of Stephen King has, where she's got some ideas, man, and they're going to make their way into these stories. And you can still see the spark of the fun stuff that kind of made her the juggernaut that she is, in the same way that Stephen King can write suspense and he can still write horror. But holy crap, you know, if they got some thoughts, specifically political ones, man, you're going to find them out, and they're not going to be subtle.
Yeah.
Bryce?
I've got a pick. It's going to be an album, and I'm going to be honest, I've only listened to half of it because I just found it last night.
Welcome to Half-Ass Picks.
Welcome to
Half
Picks. Welcome to the pit. it's. I was watching the Coachella live stream on YouTube, and one of the most arresting sort of sets that I saw was from this sort of alt-rock band, Future Islands. Do you guys know?
Love Future Islands.
Yes. And their lead singer during a live show is like the energy that he has just, and it's this very like chill, you know, chill kind of rocky alternative sort of music. But he has the voice. He's got the voice of like a death metal vocalist, but he's just crooning. It almost sounds like Jack Black. I realized this in the car on the way here. He kind of sounds like Jack Black a little bit.
I've always thought of him kind of as a, like, he has kind of like that meatloaf power voice.
Yeah.
Where it's like he's a big barrel chested guy, and he has similar to Meatloaf kind of, Meatloaf has a bit of more of an operatic kind of range. Mm-hmm. But you get a little bit of that, like, oh God, did that sound come out of that person kind of vibe.
Yeah. It's incredible. And like, if you get a chance to see that Coachella set somewhere on the internet, I don't know how you would find that, wink, wink, you should go see it, because like his performance on this album, The Far Field, is already really great. But the energy that he brings to the stage is also, it just wowed me. It wowed me in a way that of these other huge bands that I saw on the Coachella stream, like, was probably the most memorable. I think it's fantastic. That's
So do they have a new album out? I know that they came out with an album a couple years ago.
Yeah, they had one. This is a Pitchfork review from this month. This is called The Far Field is the name of the album.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just jump right ahead here just so we can I got my heart out here. Sure. My pick is the Thor Ragnarok trailer.
Ah,
so good. It's a really good trailer.
Marvel. Marvel nails it on those, and I like that. I like Brian's. Who came up with the term as Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, that was Brian.
That's Brian. It's a good one. It's a good one. Brian had a good one. Brian had a good one there.
I just love that it starts with. You're probably wondering how I got myself into
and
this.
Thor of all characters to be doing that kind of thing, you know, is just great. That it's, you know, the introspective Norse god known for his, you know, his insightful sort of monologues and stuff. So, I just fun, you know, we'll see how the movie is. But I just think about what excites me about what Marvel's been doing it. And, you know, we had Doctor Strange was a movie that I did not expect to be a good movie. I'll be flat out. I was like, meh. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved the fact that I was so wrong on that. And I think that Marvel's just got such great mojo going for it. So ecstatic.
Yeah.
So. Gentlemen, it's good to be back. It's good to be back. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.